This is the Moonfest Destiny podcast, number 33. Moonfest Destiny is a novel I wrote in 1991. My name is Peter Gelman. If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please go back and start with episode 1. Moonfest Destiny is available on Kindle for 99 cents with illustrations. I will now read Chapter 32, Reckoning at Williams Bond, a U.S. Dividend. Too much Rupert's tonic left my mind in disorder. Rupert's, to ease the pain of lacerated flesh and lacerated affection. Rupert's, to celebrate the day's victory and worry about tomorrow's. Rupert's, to fill the unfaceable nil with disorder and confusion. Only the infirmary circle stayed in the bombproof. Almost all the slow pokes slept out in the open yard. It was strange to be inside such a quiet, almost empty bombproof. Weird, the happy card sharps. They numbered the card pips by the thin flicker of a single candle. It was odd to see them laugh so wildly as they recklessly shoved piles of Liberty's Head dollars about recklessly. They slapped the winner's back. Pair of threes is all I got, and mind you, an ace. Behold my eights and nimble jack. I wasn't bluffing, but I'm out. Gentlemen, I got three fine-looking ladies. A triumvirate of filthy men, somehow eager to lose in poker. They gave up their aces in an atonement to fate to break the siege. The laughing card players, superstitious, shunned their luck and let the loser win. Lose a little poker, win a little war. It was the only way they could contribute to victory. The winner hissed and ticked. Just who was it who won? I recognized an automatonish form. Was it Franklin Stove, I wondered? Had he come back when I slept? I seemed to see him. But no, it wasn't any metal man. It was only Socrates, wearing an old silk stovepipe. He hissed in laughter and ticked the hoodoo bone against his teeth. Martha Miles shouted when she found him engaged in the sin of gambling. He gave her the money. It was hers, of course. She gave it back to the gamblers. She said she was sorely disappointed in what they had taught the rascal. She wouldn't let old Sock keep even one Liberty's Head. The other gamblers went outside to throw their money as far as they could. The other gamblers went outside to throw the money as far as they could. "You seen Sarah, ma'am?" I asked. She turned her young face to me, then looked away. "Private Borginis, since that we are no longer trapped down here, I choose not to keep company with that unfortunate girl," said Martha. "I would like to say what I hitherto have not said to you, that it is she who has led you to the fallen state you are now in. It is she who has corrupted your flesh and your soul." "That's enough of that," I warned her. Asking Kelly, I found out that Captain Miles had let out some men on scouting duty east, and some more made up a forage party west. The forage party had already come back with 4 buzzards, 3 rabbits, a lizard, and as much water as they could carry. Only a few gallons. The scouting party had returned and gone out again. Kelly didn't know where Sarah was. Kelly didn't know where Sarah was. But he'd agreed to a request for the Chicken Hawk sharpshooter to go out with the scouts the second time. Outside, there were shouts. I walked stiffly up the entryway into the bright morning. A mob was rushing out of the tents, pitched anew in the yard. They howled like madmen. All the 500 filthy, exhausted men of the 7th Infantry Cotton Balers and the 24 men from E Company, 2nd Artillery, plus all the camp wives, where was Sarah, rushed up the slopes of Fort Slowpoke to witness the second round of Taylor's duel with Lunarista. We, the wounded folks, limped up as best we could. A black cloud was lifting over Williams Bond Crater. Boom, 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 boom. We heard that cannonade for hours as Destiny's big guns made themselves manifest upon the moon's little guns. Then we heard the crackle and sputter of musketry. A giant black cloud lifted up its hideous warhead and grinned carnivorously. Its teeth flashed electric. Under its black grin, the moon waned prematurely. We saw a few lunar Zapadores running for the cold sea. Then we saw the routed hussars, many of the horses without riders, splash straight into the sea, pell-mell. Then we saw hundreds and hundreds of moon men rushing from the broken lines. Thousands fleed the U.S. iron. I saw the steam-powered pumping of the wings of one of Ringgold's flying cannon chasing them. The enemy's panic was awful to witness. The way they threw themselves into the sea, spilling on top of one another and drowning. But Taylor and the boys had busted through. Fort Texas was liberated. As we saw the doughty lines of electric bayoneteers march nigh, we cheered and cheered till hoarseness made us mum. Hip, hip, hurrah! Hurrah, old Zach and the boys! Hurrah for Rough and Ready, the next president of the United States! The first messenger galloped to our fort. Down went our drawbridge. What news? What news? 5 of our 7 captains waited at the gate. The messenger exchanged salutes, spoke a few words, listened, pulled the horse around, and galloped off again. We saw our columns marching to us, weary with victory. Came the dusty dragoons, leading their sweaty steeds and the wobbly wheeled caissons of the flying cannon, wings folded on their iron hinges, and the giant electromagnetic cannons pulled by teams of 8 oxen each. What's this? Furnaces dark and artillery pennants dipped down? Was Major Ringgold mourned then? The man who studied Napoleon, who hammered wings on ordnance, whose fleet cannon could lead a charge? Dead? Aye, Ringgold laid among the slain, his legs severed from his trunk by a lunar cannonball. Rumor said it hit one leg, pierced through the saddle and the spine of his steed, and through his other leg. More soldiers filed on down, bringing the stiffly laden mess wagons and the walking wounded, singing, "I'm lonely, my darlin', since partin' with you." I put on my regular uniform blouse. Sarah had dirt scrubbed it hard to get the blood out of it. She left it folded on my infirmary bedroll. In my pocket, I found this crookedly printed note. "Dear Jack, well, I'm sorry, but we ain't married no more. I'm so sorry, but I warned you, didn't I? And you'd never let me say it. You'd fuss, and I'd fuss. That's why I wrote this. I couldn't say it. I'm sorry. I'm no good for you, and you're no good for me. I'm a corn cob witch, and you ain't what I thought you are. You are a scholarly feller. Good luck, Sarah. P.S. If you have an extra copy of that book about Napoleon, please send it to me. I'd like that, Sarah." I saw Millie Jellison sitting in the shadow of a 6-pounder and knitting. Her belly was starting to show that she was pregnant. "Say, ma'am, do you know where Sarah is?" The camp women were dependably attentive to such details. Millie looked at me. "I heard she'd gotten a holt of some Mooner horses and came back with Cappy Sewell to get a few men to help tracking down the metal man. She said one of Taylor's scouts thought he saw a feller like him around Williams Bond Crater." "So you think she's sweet on that automaton?" I asked dryly. I figured Sarah never had a chance to give PPFS the carefully printed love note, he having flown the coop. We cotton balers didn't know whether to call it desertion or not, seeing as he had suffered so much abuse from us. Still, most folks didn't care either way. He was a bit too weird and Whiggish for the most of us. "You think so?" Millie said with a shake of her red locked head that was either a gesture of sympathy or incredulousness, or maybe both. "Didn't she tell you she don't love me no more?" I asked. "Shoot, Mr. Borganis, do you think a girl could love a metal man?" "Wouldn't some girls prefer a metal man?" "How you talk," she chided me. I reread Sarah's note. I mean the one addressed to me. I left the other in her apron. "So, what did she think I was? A scholarly feller? Had I changed, or was she wrong all the while? I couldn't remember what I was a week ago, especially. I couldn't figure what she thought I was. Ha! I went looking for Kelly. He seemed to know all about it. He wanted me to sign up as a stretcher bearer. It would look good on my poor record. I didn't have to do anything, though, seeing as I was already on sick call. He would just note that I volunteered. All right, I said, but I have a permission to request. He gave me written permission to hunt for our lost mule. He thought I wanted to go off and be alone with nature, like a German poet that Klager used to talk about, like young Werther. At the gate, I asked which way Captain Sewell rode off. Featherstone pointed out their hoof trail. I limped behind them, heading east on the trail of the metal man, grumbling, "Princess Vice President Sarah Stove." I didn't know what I was going to do. Maybe I was going to do a little bushwhacking in the name of true love. Maybe I was going to do a little score settling, electric musket retribution, in the name of Joseph Bentley. Maybe this was my chance to get even with my bad luck. Slaying that moral engine would be like slaying an agent of our flawed Creator. That there was no divine justice? Ha! I'd teach that highfalutin automatumnal righteousness. Man, machine, angel, or devil, may he be. But this was my own vanity and error. Prince President Franklin Stowe was in large part an engine, certainly. In the form of a man, certainly. With astonishing preternatural powers of Babbage calculating machine cogitation. To the point of suspecting diabolic inspiration. It seemed so much, too much. Did he know? It. Did it know? And yet, as I soon found out, all simple categorical suppositions that solved the mystery of his nature were false when they excluded the key element, the elective element, the bestial element of its intelligence. Things did not happen like I expected. Thank you for listening. Okay, here's a discussion question inspired by that chapter. Speaking philosophically on a cosmic scale, if you can imagine, what is the difference between a citizen, a slave, an automaton, and a mule? What are the shades of differences in terms of free will and the sources of their choices of actions? I think following chapters will try to shed a little more light on that. There are only a couple chapters left, and they have an opinion about that. Please visit my website, dangerquestmysteries.com, or if you would like to send me a kind note, my email address is petergelman@yahoo.com. More podcasts I will be releasing are Mysterious Matters of Max Metters. I'm going to re-record and re-release my humorous and unusual bicycle stories called Mysteries of the Bicycle Explained. I also have a strange bicycle adventure story I will be releasing. I will be releasing these over time on Kindle as well. I hope you enjoyed the story so far. Thank you very much for listening. Moonifest Destiny by Peter Gelman is available on Kindle for 99 cents.